to the reading of the Telegram Herald for Wednesday, June 29th, 2022. And I am your reader, Pete Welch. Wessels sentenced for wire fraud. Former administrator for Holy Family Catholic Schools described as master manipulator. In Cedar Rapids, a former administrator who stole more than $500,000 from Holy Family Catholic Schools in Dubuque was sentenced Tuesday to more than 3 years in federal prison. Todd C. Wessels, age 50, of Dubuque, was sentenced in U.S. District Court in Cedar Rapids to 3 years and 5 months in prison after previously pleading guilty to one count of wire fraud. The Telegraph Herald attended the sentencing hearing. Wessels also must serve 3 years of supervised release after his prison term. There is no parole in the federal system. This was a systematic, constant fleecing of an organization, Judge C.J. Williams said when administering the sentence. The defendant used his position to deprive this organization of funds badly needed. It's not lost on the court. The defendant stole over $500,000 and there's nothing to show for it. Some people steal and invest. Somehow he blew $500,000 over the course of 10 years. Wessels also must pay the Archdiocese of Dubuque $507,466 in restitution. Investigators determined that Wessels stole $503,539 of that amount from Holy Family. The federal charge to which Wessels pleaded guilty is connected with his use of a PayPal account to buy a handmade string instrument for $449 in 2019, according to court documents. However, recently filed court documents state that Wessels stole more than $500,000 from Holy Family starting no later than June 2011 through at least February 2020. Documents also note that due to a lack of written inventory, the full extent of Wessels' thefts, is unknown. Wessels previously served as principal of Holy Ghost Elementary School and as Holy Family's curriculum technology director. He was placed on administrative leave in February of 2020 and resigned the following month. He later agreed to have his teaching privileges in Iowa permanently revoked. Court documents state that Wessels purchased prepaid debit cards using Holy Family store credit cards under the pretense of needing the money for computer apps and office supplies. He transferred that money to a PayPal account he had opened in Holy Family's name and provided receipts for the purchase of the cards on the pretense that they were used for school purchases. Court documents state that Wessels used Holy Family funds to buy items and services for himself and his family, including paying for travel expenses, theater tickets, food expense, and Wessels' electric bill at his residence. Other purchases listed in the documents included a swimming pool, expensive light bulbs, beef brisket, virtual reality headsets, robots, Apple TVs, and more than a dozen Beats earbuds and earphones. Philip Borman, Holy Family's chief administrator, said during the sentencing hearing that Wessels was a trusted employee when questions about his spending first came to light in October of 2019. After Wessels was put on leave of absence, he posted on Facebook expressing gratitude to his supporters, Borman said. Todd is a master manipulator, and he's able to project to others what he needed them to see, Borman said. The outpouring of belief in his innocence when he resigned and to this day is outstanding. Borman said that Holy Family officials would have been able to pay another full-time employee with benefits with the amount of money Wessels stole each year. I'm thankful he's no longer an employee, he said. I shudder to think at the thought of Todd in charge of over $1 million in COVID relief. Attorneys also argued on Tuesday about the length of Wessels' sentence. Assistant U.S. Attorney Timothy Verrick asked for a sentence ranging from 3 years and 5 months to 4 years and 3 months. As best as the government can tell, The defendant's motive was greed, he said. He wanted things for himself and his family that others could afford. Verrick said that noted that Wessels was one of the highest paid employees at Holy Family. This was not a misunderstanding, he said. This was a scheme to defraud in a very sophisticated fashion. It was a punch to the gut to the school district. Wessels' attorney, Jennifer Fries, asked for a 2-year prison sentence, noting that Wessels no longer wanted to contest paying restitution after reading submitted victims' impact statements. She also said that Wessels, since he's been diagnosed with depression, anxiety, and bipolar disorder, Wessels overdosed on his medication twice since the investigation began, she said, including just after he was placed on leave of absence. Instead of running, instead of committing further crimes, this is a man who is undergoing mental health treatment, Fries said. Wessels also spoke of his struggles with mental health during his sentencing. These conditions influenced my decision-making, he said. During down times, I would buy things to make myself feel better. During up times, I would engage in more risky behavior. Wessels also apologized for the hurt he caused the Holy Family community. I don't use my bipolar disorder as an excuse for my behavior, but I hope it is recognized that the disorder makes a person make risky decisions, he said. Williams said that he did not see a clear connection between Wessels' diagnosis and his decision to steal from Holy Family, but that Wessels' actions may have caused feelings of anxiety and guilt. The impact of a crime like this is incalculable, he said. There are consequences beyond the financial impact. People don't trust each other. City details plans for Central Avenue. Business and property owners say that proposed designs do not provide enough public parking. In Dubuque City, officials on Tuesday presented redesigned proposals to create a public plaza along a major downtown roadway. Attendees of a public meeting had the chance to see two proposed redesigns for the Central Avenue Streetscape master plan after businesses and property owners complained about plans for a plaza at the intersection of Central Avenue and East 18th Street. About 20 people attended the meeting, which was presented by the city's Economic Development Department at the Multicultural Family Center. The plan, which calls for converting Central from 11th to 22nd Streets from a one-way road to a two-way thoroughfare, originally proposed closing East 18th Street at its intersection with Central to construct the plaza. The proposed redesigns would keep East 18th Street open and create additional parking. The modifications were made in response to concerns from businesses and property owners on Central who feared that the creation of the plaza would reduce parking availability. There was concern about closing the street, but I would say that the biggest concern was actually parking, said Ryan Peterson of RDG Planning and Design, which is developing the Central Avenue plan with the city. We've heard from people saying that we want the site to accommodate multiple uses. The original plan presented to Dubuque City Council in 2019 called for converting Central from 11th to 22nd Streets to a two-way road and reducing the street width to expand the size of sidewalks and greenery, along with closing East 18th Street between Central Avenue and White Street for the plaza. The project aims to redevelop Central in an effort to spur economic growth along the roadway. While the project stalled during the pandemic, city leaders this year started working to update the plan by gathering input from local businesses and property owners. The two redesigned options presented on Tuesday would retain many elements of the original plan, but would make changes to the proposed plaza. Both options would keep the affected stretch of East 18th Street open and create a smaller plaza next to it. Additional parking would be created along East 19th Street, and green alleys would be constructed between Central Avenue and White Street to connect 18th Street and 17th Street. The two redesign options differ in their approach to developing the plaza. The first option would create a plaza that entirely blocks off access to East 18th Street from Central Avenue through traffic still could access the portion of East 18th Street behind the plaza near White Street. The second option would create a one-way road next to the plaza that could channel vehicles on Central Avenue onto East 18th Street. Meeting attendees varied in which design option they preferred. Proponents of the first design option said it would provide the safest pedestrian access for residents and that a roadway next to the plaza could pose a safety risk. I just see so many more pros to the first design option for the foot traffic, said Michaela Freeberger, program coordinator for Dubuque County Energy District and a small business development center consultant. I just see the second option as a safety concern, even though there is a walking area. Several attendees said that the second option provides a necessary access point to East 18th Street, one of the more prominent businesses on Central Avenue, Key City Creative Center, which is at the corner of 18th and Central. Without the access road from Central Avenue to East 18th Street, people only could access Key City Creative Center via White Street. Tim Hitzler, founder of Key City Creative Center, said he believes that having the additional access road to East 18th Street wouldn't take away much from the proposed plaza and stressed that any design of Central Avenue should work to benefit all existing and potential businesses. Flexibility is key, Hitzler said. There are a lot of unknowns at this point. Peterson said that the city and RDG will continue to gather input on the redesigns of the Central Avenue corridor, streetscape, master plan, and eventually present it to Dubuque City Council in a future work session. Dave Lyson, sustainable innovations consultant with Great Dubuque Development Corp, said that the ultimate goal of the project is to spur further investment in the corridor. We would want to get started yet this year, he said. And in other news, inflation stressing food banks. U.S. Labor of Statistics says that the grocery prices have jumped by 12% over the past year. There's a caption here, and it says St. Stephen's Food Bank site director Kathy Hunton moves a pallet of food. Area food pantries are feeling the strain of both rising community needs and increasing costs to provide services. As of Tuesday, the national inflation rate was about 8.6%, a 40-year high, with average grocery store prices up 12% from 1 year earlier, according to the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics. Leaders of local food pantries and organizations that provide free meals said that the increased cost of living has driven more people to use their service than they saw even during the COVID-19 pandemic. Kathy Hutton is the site's director at Dubuque St. Stephen's Food Bank, a branch of River Bend Food Bank. She said that she recently spoke to a married mother of six who had overstretched her household food budget for the first time due to high prices. We're having calls all the time from people who have never had to use a food pantry before and don't know the process, she said. Hutton said that the numbers of people turning to St. Stephen's for food has increased by 15% in recent months. Tom Townsend manages Dubuque Area Labor Harvest, which provides free meals most Saturdays and grocery deliveries twice per month. He said need has jumped sharply for the group's services, which has put a strain on the volunteers that provide them. We had settled in where we were doing about 50 deliveries every 2 weeks for about a year, he said. The last few months, it's been closer to 80 to 100. When it gets up where it is, we're struggling with the number of volunteers for deliveries and the amount of time it takes to get them ready. Ben Anderson helps run East Dubuque Food Pantry. He said that the pantry has served about 60 families per week recently, an increase of around 20%. The pantry has been able to handle that so far, but he said he worries about how sustainable that is. Right at this time, we're in fairly good shape financially and with food, he says. There's, again, that something that's subject to monthly changes. Many food pantries and free food services in the area use the Davenport-based River Bend Food Bank. River Bend Director of Marketing and Communications Liz Durhoff said that the economy has stressed the food bank's system as well. when inflation comes around and you see bare shelves at the grocery store, that means those distributors and grocers don't have those items to send to us either, he said. She said, rather. Anything extra they have in their stores, we're seeing them repurposing, redistributing in different ways, cutting back on what they're ordering to try and match what consumers are purchasing. So we are seeing a decrease in donations from our larger corporate partners. Dierwolf said that the Federal Emergency Food Assistance Program, one of the biggest resources of Riverbend's food and funding, also has been overstressed lately. We've had about 15% or 17% of our orders canceled through that program, which means they didn't have the food supply that we asked for, or they weren't able to get it in the time frame when we needed it, she said. That puts a dent in what we're getting at a discount or free, which means we have to purchase our food. Dierwolf said that these factors make Riverbend more susceptible to a still fragile supply chain and incidental problems such as a recent Jif peanut butter recall. The problems have hit Riverbend's food reserves. We normally have about 500,000 pounds to 1 million pounds of food in our 60,000 square foot warehouse at any given time, she said. Right now, it's odd and eerie. There are quite a few empty racks in our warehouse right now. Organizations reported different areas of need so they can weather the current storm. Dierwolf and Riverbend mostly is in need of money because it provides food to so many other services. Every dollar we receive creates about five meals, she said. Since we're having to purchase more food, monetary donations are really, really helpful. But Dierwolf also said that the company and institutions offer what food they can spare, too. If you have food at home that you know you won't eat or which has reached what we call the donate date, because expiration dates other than on infant formula are actually best by dates and mean that the producer thinks it will taste great by that date or wants you to eat or drink it so you'll buy it again. Unless it's bulging or rusting or smells weird, it's perfectly safe, and we would love to get it to someone who could use it, she says. Local groups expressed a need for more volunteers. Dawn Drake runs Ruby's Pantry for Platteville, Wisconsin, United Methodist Church, and she said that it takes 80 volunteers to keep the pantry going, and finding those volunteers becomes difficult in the summer. During the school year, we have a number of students from University of Wisconsin, Platteville, which helps, she said. Despite those challenges, leaders at area services said that they had not run out of food and remain open, especially if they can find a little bit more help. And now let's take a look at other news in the Dubuque and Tri-State area. Police, foreign hackers steal $300,000 from Five Flags accounts. City of Dubuque reports that no city accounts or departments were impacted. Authorities said a hacker fraudulently obtained hundreds of thousands of dollars from a bank account belonging to Dubuque's Five Flags Center. Hackers stole $300,000 through an unauthorized transaction made via Midwest One Bank sometime from Friday to Monday, according to Dubuque police. It was a financial hack from outside the U.S., said Dubuque Police Department Lieutenant Ted McLennan. We're still trying to sort out how that happened. Hackers apparently requested a wire transfer through the bank and were able to obtain the funds. Contacted by the Telegraph Herald, Five Flags staff directed questions about the case to Dubuque police. The city of Dubuque reported that no city accounts or departments were impacted. It's the city's understanding that the fraudulent activity was isolated to a Five Flags Center account managed by ASM Global, the company the city contracts with for the management operation of the Five Flags Center, a city spokesman wrote in an email to the TH. The email later added that the Five Flags account impacted by the attack is wholly controlled by ASM Global. It is partially funded by the annual operating subsidy provided to ASM Global by the City of Dubuque, as outlined in the facility management contract. Peggy Hudson, Senior Vice President of Marketing for Midwest One in Dubuque, said that an email to the TH that an investigation into the case is underway. As is usual with financial crimes, we cannot comment at this time without jeopardizing the process of those working on it, she said in the email. McClemon said that the police were able to determine that the hack originated from outside the U.S. after reviewing bank correspondence. And now over to Galena, Illinois. Galena Council hears residents' concerns about U.S. 20 detour. In response to concerns from residents impacted by a detour, Galena officials this week promised to address the issue with signs and continued police presence. The detour is part of a $31 million improvement project on U.S. 20 Illinois 84 that includes a new roadway, curbs and gutters, storm sewers, sidewalks, shared-use path, relocated water and sanitary facilities, and retaining walls. Eastbound highway traffic is being detoured onto Gear and Bench streets, with westbound traffic remaining on the highway. Jeff and Cynthia Bishop live on the corner of South Bench and Gear streets, the intersection at which the detour rejoins US 20. Our little slice of heaven is really turning into a little slice of hell right now, Jeff told city council members during their meeting this week. He described constant engine braking dust and a strong diesel smell since the detour started on June 20th. The bishops asked council members for immediate permission to construct a fence on their property, which would typically require a permit from the city's zoning administrator. We need to have something to protect ourselves, Jeff said. Council members expressed their willingness to work with the bishops on the fence request and also discussed other options to curb the issue. I'm very concerned about what I'm hearing about Gear Street, and your input is not the first that I've heard about, Councilmember Pam Bernstein told the bishops. People are really being taxed to the limit up there, and I think we really need to police those trucks. That would certainly be a step in the right direction. City Administrator Mark Morin said that the city installed a mobile radar speed sign on the first half of the detour and plans to install an additional sign on the second half. A sign reminding drivers to avoid engine braking also will be moved from its current position near the highway to the downhill section of Gear Street. Moran added that the police are patrolling the area and running radar to monitor speeds. We'll continue to have a presence there just to try to encourage speeds within the limit, he said after the meeting. Mayor Terry Renner asked that the city staff place the issue on the agenda for the council's next meeting so that officials can discuss the issue in further detail and determine how to help citizens with requests such as the bishop's fence. He also said that the city might seek assistance from state troopers to monitor engine braking. The project is scheduled for completion by the fall of 2024, Moran said. The detour is expected to remain in place the entire time, with the exception of during winter. And in other news, the city hires legal firm in response to lawsuit. Galena City Council members this week voted to hire AGHL Law of Rockford, Illinois, for a legal representation in the lawsuit of the city faces from resident Wendy Clark. Clark's suit, filed this month against the city and the project developers, alleges that city officials failed to meet the requirements of city codes and state law in approving rezoning requests for the Parker project on the property that includes Galena Marine Hospital. It also argues that city officials did not adequately consider the impacts of the project on nearby residents when making their decision. The Parker proposals first came before the city's zoning boards of appeals in February. After multiple meetings this spring, city council members last month approved an ordinance rezoning the property from limited agriculture to planned unit development, along with an ordinance forming and annexing 56.2 acres of the 80-acre development that was located outside city limits. Those ordinances cleared the way for works to begin on the project. In addition to restoration of the Marine Hospital, the Parker will involve four construction phases culminating in more than 100 cottages, a cafe, building, a restaurant, an event center, outdoor dining areas, a vineyard, walking trails, and other amenities. And now let's turn to some news briefs. Authorities identify driver killed in Dubuque County crash at Holy Cross, Iowa. Authorities on Tuesday morning released the name of the driver killed in a crash Monday in Dubuque County. Heath Stuckey, age 33, of Gutenberg, was pronounced dead at the scene, according to the Dubuque County Sheriff's Department. A press release states that Stuckey was driving south in the 16,000 block of Holy Cross Road sometime before 4:50 a.m. on Monday, when the vehicle entered the east ditch, struck a driveway entrance, and became airborne. The vehicle rolled, causing the fatal injuries to Stuckey, who was its sole occupant. And in other news, man pleads guilty to federal charge related to Dubuque shooting. A man pleaded guilty recently to a federal charge related to a Dubuque shooting. D'Angelo D. Washington, age 23, pleaded guilty in U.S. District Court in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, to a charge of possession of a firearm by a felon. U.S. Magistrate Judge Mark Roberts filed documents recommending to accept the plea. A sentence due has not yet been set. Documents stated that Washington could be sentenced to up to 10 years in prison, followed by a 3-year supervised release period. There's no parole in the federal system. Court documents state that Dubuque police responded at about 2 a.m. October 31st to the area of 14th Street and Central Avenue after a disturbance was reported. While officers were investigating, they heard multiple gunshots in the area. Three spent shell casings and a handgun were found, documents state. No injuries were reported. Police used camera footage from the area to identify Washington as the shooter. Federal court documents state the footage shows Washington leaving a gas station at 1401 Central Avenue and firing multiple shots in the direction of a vehicle. Washington has multiple prior felony convictions. He originally was charged in Iowa District Court of Dubuque County with intimidation with a dangerous weapon, going armed with intent, and possession of a firearm by a felon for the shooting. However, those state-level charges were dismissed after the federal charges were filed. And in other news briefs, Jackson County Development Group touts economic gains in Bellevue, Iowa. Economic development officials said Jackson County gained commercial investment and experienced an increase in wages in recent years. Jackson County Economic Alliance recently held its annual Investor and Partners Appreciation event, at which officials touted some of the county's accomplishments. The county gained more than $15 million in commercial investments last year, according to building permits. The county has experienced more than $75 million of investment during the past 4 years. The average wage for Jackson County was $18.73 during the first quarter of 2022. The Alliance Board of Directors announced in 2018 a goal to increase the average wages by $2 per hour to $16.50, a figure since surpassed. And in other news briefs, Field of Dreams TV series lands $6 million Destination Iowa grant. Producers of a streaming television series inspired by the Field of Dreams movie are receiving a boost from the state of Iowa. Universal Television was awarded a $6 million Destination Iowa grant for the development of the television series. A press release states that the filming will be based in several Iowa counties, including Polk, Mahaska, Boone, and Clinton, with the primary sets located in Polk City. Producers plan to construct a ball field and refurbish a farmhouse in Polk City. Filming is scheduled to begin later this year. The limited series adaptation from Michael Schur is expected to be streamed by NBC's Peacock service. The Destination Iowa grant program provides funding and transformational attractions that will bolster the quality of life in Iowa communities and attract visitors and new residents, according to the press release. The state this week announced awards totaling $16.5 million through the program, which will allocate a total of $100 million. Two local projects have been submitted for funding consideration through the program. The city of Dyersville applied for a $12.5 million towards the construction of a $50 million, 3,000-seat permanent baseball stadium at the Field of Dreams movie site. And the city of Maquoketa, Jackson County, and Jackson County Conservation seek up to about $800,000 for development of Prairie Creek Recreation Area next to Maquoketa along Iowa Highway 64. You're listening to the Telegraph Herald on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now, let's turn to today's obituaries. Jane M. Avenaris, age 68, of Ashbury, has passed on June 26th at her home. A prayer service will be held at 3 p.m. on Thursday, the 30th of June, at Hoffman, Schneider, and Kitchen Funeral Home and Crematory, followed by visitation until 7 p.m. The Mass of Christian Burial for Jane will be at 1 p.m. Friday, July 1st, at Church of the Resurrection and Father Philip Aggie as the celebrant. Burial will be in Lidwood Cemetery in Dubuque. Arthur L. Goodwin, age 88, has passed of Scales Mound, Illinois, formerly of Port Bryan, Illinois, passed on June 26. Funeral services will be 10:30 a.m. July 1st at Shepherd of the Hills Lutheran Church in Shapville, Illinois, with Reverend James Meltreder officiating. Burial will be in the Scales Mount Cemetery. Geraldine Mormon, Sister Geraldine Mormon, age 99, of Mount Camel Bluffs at 1160 Camel Drive, Dubuque, has passed. Funeral services will be Friday, the 1st of July, 2022, in the Mary Frances Clark Chapel at Mount Carmel Bluffs. Masks are required. Visitation will begin at 9 a.m., followed by the sharing of memories at 9:30 a.m. The Mass of Christian Burial begins at 10:30 a.m. Burial will be in the Mount Carmel Cemetery. And let's now turn to some other news briefs. Unemployment rates in local counties fall compared to 1 year ago. Unemployment rates are in local counties fell in May compared to a year earlier, according to recently released data. Dubuque County's unemployment rate was 2.2% in May, down from 2.4% in April, and 4.4% in May 2021, according to Iowa Workforce Development. Elsewhere in the state, Clayton County's unemployment rate was 2.4% in May, down from 4.4% 1 year earlier. Delaware County's rate was 1.7%, down from 3.2%. Jackson County's rate was down 2.5% from 5%. Jones County rate was 2.4%, and that was down from 4.3%. Statewide, Iowa's seasonally adjusted unemployment rate was 2.7% in May, down from 4.5% a year earlier. In Wisconsin, Crawford County's unemployment rate was 3.1% in May, down from 4.3% in May 2021, according to the state's Department of Workforce Development. Grant County's rate was 2.3%, down from 3.1%. Iowa County's rate was 2.3%, down from 3.5%. Lafayette County rate was 1.9%, the lowest in the state, down from 2.6%. Statewide, Wisconsin's unemployment rate was 2.9% in May, down from 4.1% in May 2021. In Illinois, Joe Davies County's unemployment rate was 3.5% in May, down from 3.6% a year earlier, according to the Illinois Department of Employment Security. And now let's take a look at some other news in Dubuque. Dubuque casinos see revenue dip in May. The casino official says that last month's downturn extended across the Midwest. Dubuque's two casinos both saw a dip in gaming revenues last month compared in 1 year earlier, which officials attributed to ongoing economic pressures such as inflation and rising gas prices. Leaders of the DRA, the nonprofit license holder for Dubuque's casinos, which legally is called the Dubuque Racing Association discussed the decrease in revenues at their monthly board meeting on Tuesday. May was a tough month for gaming in Dubuque, Alex Dixon, president and CEO of Q Casino, said during the meeting. We saw broadly across for our market and both of our facilities, and there was just difficulty. Diamond Joe Casino and Q Casino reported a combined $10.8 million in gambling revenue in May, down about 12% from May 2021, which was a total then of $12.3 million. Diamond Joe reported $6.3 million in gaming revenues in May, down from $7.1 million in May 2021. Q Casinos generated $4.5 million in gaming revenue last month, compared to $5.2 million during the same time period last year. Brian Rakestraw, Q Casino Vice President and General Manager, said last month's downturn in gaming revenue extended across the Midwest. If you look all across Iowa, across Missouri, they all saw decreases as compared to last year, he said after the meeting. I think with the gas prices and the economy and the inflation and things happening, people are really watching their budgets and disposable income a little bit tighter. He said Q Casino officials have seen the most significant decline in gaming revenue from individuals who must travel longer distances to the casino, which they attribute to continually rising gas prices. We're seeing that what we call our middle market and outer market, which is probably 25 miles or further out, is where we're seeing the largest decrease compared to Dubuque and our local market, he said. Both Dixon and Rakestraw emphasized that strong revenues in the first 4 months of the year mean that Q Casino remains in a positive financial position for the year overall. Increases in other aspects of operations last month, including hotel bookings, also helped buoy the casino finances despite the gaming revenue downturn. We're being diligent within the business to make sure that we are mindful of expenses, Dixon said at the meeting. Fortunately, we've had a great start to 2022, and so we foresee that we're going to be just fine as it relates to full-year results. But this is concerning as it relates to the overall market. In Bellevue, a Bellevue man was killed in a farming accident this week. Albert L. Nakey, age 91, died as a result of the incident, according to a funeral home notice. The crash happened at around 10 a.m. Monday in a timber area of a private property located southwest of Bellevue, according to a Jackson County Sheriff's Department report. The report states that Nakey was driving a side-by-side ATV when his vehicle slid and rolled sideways down an embankment. Nakey was partially ejected from the vehicle and pinned under the ATV roof's line. And now to Washington. Trump wanted to join January 6th crowd, says aide. Cassidy Hutchinson testifies that the former president had dismissed threats of attack on the Capitol. In Washington, former President Donald Trump fought security officials for control of the presidential SUV as he struggled to get to the Capitol during the January 6, 2021 insurrection. A key former White House aide told White House investigators on Tuesday, even after he had been told that some of his supporters were armed. Trump had said that the protesters were not here to hurt me, recalled Cassidy Hutchinson, testifying before the House panel investigating the insurrection, told by security officials that it wasn't safe to go to the Capitol after he addressed his supporters. Trump lunged toward the steering wheel of the armed vehicle, he says. The 25-year-old former aide said she was told of the altercation in the SUV, dubbed the Beast, immediately afterward by White House security officials, and that Bobby Engel, the head of the detail, was in the room and didn't dispute the account. Engel had grabbed Trump's arm to prevent him from gaining control of the armored vehicle, she was told, and Trump then used his free hand to lunge at Engel. Hutchinson, then as special assistant to White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows, described chaos inside and outside the White House that day as hundreds of Trump supporters marched toward the Capitol, shouting the president's false claims of widespread fraud in the 2020 election. Aides inside of the executive mansion, several of whom had been warned of violence beforehand, became increasingly alarmed as rioters at the Capitol overran the police, broke through the windows and doors, and intercepted the certification of Joe Biden's victory. Trump was less concerned, even as he heard there were cries in the crowd to hang Mike Pence. Hutchinson recalled that Meadows told aides that Trump thinks Mike deserves it. The president tweeted it during the attack that Pence didn't have the courage to object to Biden's win as he presided over the joint session of Congress. As for the rioters, Meadows said that Trump didn't think they're doing anything wrong. Hutchinson told the panel that former president had been informed early in the day that some of the protesters in the crowd outside the White House had weapons, but he told officials to remove metal detectors to let my people in and march to the Capitol. Hutchinson's explosive testimony came at the latest of the sessions in the House committee investigating the Capitol insurrection is conducting to inform the public about what happened as Trump supporters broke into the Capitol and sent lawmakers running from the House and Senate. Trump denied much of what Hutchinson said on his social media platform, Truth Social, including that he tried to grab the steering wheel of the presidential SUV or that he said Mike Pence deserved to be hung. I hardly know who this person Cassidy Hutchinson is, Trump wrote, calling her a total phony and bad news. In other news, Ghislaine Maxwell gets 20-year prison sentence. In New York, the jet-setting socialite who once consorted with royals and presidents and billionaires was sentenced Tuesday to 20 years in prison for helping financier Jeffrey Epstein sexually abuse underage girls. The stiff sentence was a victory for a group of women who spent years fighting for justice after an earlier generation of prosecutors failed to pursue the predatory power couple. Epstein, who killed himself in 2019 while awaiting trial, sexually abused children hundreds of times over more than a decade, exploiting vulnerable girls as young as 14. Prosecutors said he couldn't have done so without the help of Maxwell, his longtime companion. Maxwell, wearing a blue prison uniform and a white mask to conform with coronavirus rules, looked to one side as the sentence was announced, but otherwise did not react. She wore leg shackles that could be heard rattling when she walked into the courtroom. The sentence was shorter than the term sought by prosecutors, but Epstein's accusers still expressed relief. It's been an incredibly long road to justice for myself and for many other survivors, said Sarah Ransom, one of Epstein's accusers. This is for the girls that don't have their say, the ones that weren't there. A jury in December convicted Maxwell, age 60, of sex trafficking, transporting a minor to participate in illegal sex acts, and two conspiracy charges. Judge Allison J. Nathan noted as she imposed the prison term and a $750,000 fine that Maxwell never expressed remorse for her crimes. The judge said that she wanted the sentence to send an unmistakable message that nobody was above the law. Addressing the court earlier, Maxwell stood at a lectern and said she empathized with the survivors and hoped her punishment would bring them peace, but she did not admit culpability and laid blame for the abuse on Epstein, saying meeting him was the greatest regret of my life. And now turning to other news in Denver, in state primaries, abortion at center of key races. In Denver, Colorado Republicans on Tuesday nominated a businessman and supporter of most abortion rights for U.S. Senate while rejecting an attempt by one of the nation's most prominent election deniers to become their candidate for the state's top voting post. Joe O'Dea won the GOP's Senate nomination after saying he supported a late-term abortion ban. But before then, the decision should be left up to a woman and her God. At the same time, Mesa County Clerk Tina Peters, who's been indicted for her role as a break-in of her county's own election system, lost her bid for the party's Secretary of State nomination. It was won instead by Pam Anderson, a former suburban Denver clerk, who has been critic of former President Donald Trump's election lies, which Peters has embraced. The wins came as voters in seven states cast ballots in the first primary since the Supreme Court last week revoked the constitutional rights for women to obtain abortions. Also on Tuesday, Illinois Republicans chose a supporter of an abortion ban with no exceptions as their gubernatorial candidate. State Senator and farmer Darren Bailey gained Trump's endorsement and more than $16 million in support from Democrats who pushed conservatives to select him over Richard Irvin, the first black mayor of Aurora, the state's second largest city. Irvin was seen as a far more formidable challenge to Governor J.B. Pritzker and was backed heavily by Republican donors. Also in Illinois, Darren LaHood won the Republican nomination for U.S. House in the 16th Congressional District. Democrats unsuccessfully tried to replicate their Illinois strategy in Colorado. There, Democrats spent more than $4 million to boost the U.S. Senate campaign of State Republican Ron Hanks, who favors an abortion ban without exceptions in order to deny the GOP nominations to Odea. Odea is seen as far stronger candidate against the incumbent Democratic Senator Michael Bennett. Abortion became an even more fraught issue in Tuesday's primaries after the Supreme Court decision. Political operatives predict more electoral bank shots like one Democrats executed in Illinois, as Republicans feel emboldened by the repeal of the 1973 ruling in Roe v. Wade. Beyond Colorado and Illinois, elections are being held in Oklahoma, Utah, New York, Nebraska, Mississippi, and South Carolina Tuesday, which marks the final round of multi-state primary nights until August, when closely watched races for governor and the U.S. Senate will unfold in Arizona, Wisconsin, Florida, Missouri, and other states. In Oklahoma, one of the nation's most conservative senators, James Lankford, won his primary challenge from evangelical pastor Jackson LaMayer amid conservative anger that Lankford hasn't supported Trump's election claims. In Utah, two Republican critics of Trump are targeting Senator Mike Lee, accusing the two-term senator of being too preoccupied with winning the former president's favor and helping him try to overturn the 2020 presidential election. In Mississippi, Representative Michael Guest, a Republican who bucked Trump to vote for an independent January 6th commission, faces a challenge from Michael Cassidy, a former Navy pilot. Also in Colorado, Firebrand Representative Lauren Boebert easily defeated her primary challenger, moderate state senator Don Corum. And now turning internationally, Macron says Russia can't win in Ukraine after strike on mall. France's president denounced Russia's fiery airstrike on a crowded shopping mall in Ukraine as a new war crime Tuesday, and vowed that the West's support for Kyiv would not waver, saying Moscow cannot and should not win the war. The strike, which killed at least 18 people in the central city of Kremchuk, came as leaders from the group of seven nations met in Europe. It was part of an unusually intense barrage of Russian fire across Ukraine, including in the capital, Kyiv, the renewed international attention as the war drags on. Speaking at the end of the G7 summit in Germany, French President Macron appeared to address that concern, vowing that the seven leading industrialized democracies would support Ukraine and maintain sanctions against Russia as long as necessary and with the necessary intensity. Russia cannot and should not win, he said. He called Monday's attack on the mall a new war crime. As they have in other attacks, Russian officials claim the shopping center was not the target. In a virtual address to the UN Security Council, the Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, accused Russian President Putin of being a terrorist and called for Russia to be expelled from the United Nations. He also urged the UN to establish an international tribunal to investigate Russia's action in Ukraine. Zelensky ended his address by asking all the chamber to stand in silent tribute to the tens of thousands of Ukrainian children and adults killed in the war. All council members rose, including Russia's deputy U.S. Ambassador Dmitry Polinsky. Rescuers combed through the charred rubble of the shopping mall, which officials said was struck when more than 1,000 afternoon shoppers and workers were inside. Many of those inside quickly fled the building when an air raid siren sounded and took shelter across the street. In addition to the 18 killed, authorities said 59 were wounded, while 21 people were still missing. And now let's turn to some other news briefs. Hinckley says he's sorry for shooting that wounded Reagan. In Washington, the man who wounded President Ronald Reagan in 1981 apologized for his actions Tuesday and said he doesn't remember what he was feeling when he fired the shots that also wounded three others. John Hinckley told CBS Morning in his first televised interview since he was freed from all court oversight this month that he feels sorry for all the lives his actions have affected. "I feel badly for all of them. I've true remorse for what I did," Hinckley says. "I know that they probably can't forgive me now, but I just want them to know that I am sorry for what I did." U.S. conservationists call for action on Northwest wolf poaching in Spokane, Washington. Wildlife advocates say that there has been a distressing uptick in wolf poaching cases in the Northwest in the past year and a half. Four dead wolves were discovered in the northeastern corner of Washington State in February that followed the poisoning of eight wolves in eastern Oregon in 2021, along with the poaching of a total of eight wolves in Idaho last year. While the numbers are small, they are a big jump over previous years. Oregon had a total of 10 confirmed wolf poaching between 2017 and 2020. Washington had no confirmed wolf poachings from 2017 through 2021. Data for 2017 through 2019 was not available for Idaho, but the state had three confirmed wolf poachings in 2020. Wolf experts say that the actual number of poaching incidents is likely much higher. The cases were difficult to solve because they occur in remote rural areas where a perpetrator can kill a wolf and bury the body. And in London, Scottish leader calls for a new independence vote. Scotland's leader told lawmakers in Edinburgh Tuesday that she plans to hold a fresh referendum on Scotland's independence on October 19, 2023, even though UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson maintains it wasn't the right time for such a vote. First Minister Nicola Sturgeon said that the question to be asked will be the same as that in Scotland's first independent vote in 2014. Should Scotland be an independent country? The UK-wide government of Johnson opposes a new referendum and has repeatedly said that the issue was settled in 2014 when 55% that they wanted to remain part of the United Kingdom. Scotland's government requires a special order from Johnson to legally hold a referendum. Sturgeon said that she will ask the UK Supreme Court to rule on the Scottish government's right to hold the vote if Johnson does not give the go-ahead. Russian oligarch docks yacht in Haven, Dubai. In Dubai, the man considered to be the wealthiest oligarch in Russia, who has been photographed playing ice hockey with President Vladimir Putin, joins a growing list of those transferring or sailing their prized assets to Dubai as the West tightens its massive sanctions program on Russia's economy. Vladimir Putin, head of the world's largest refined nickel and palladium producer, may not be sanctioned by the United States or Europe. Yet, such sanctions could roil metal markets and potentially disrupt supply chains, experts say. As the biggest shareholders in mining company, Nornickel, Potatnin had a personal fortune of $30.6 billion before the war in Ukraine, according to Forbes. but like an increasing number of blacklisted Russian oligarchs, he has apparently taken the precaution of moving his $300 million superyacht to the safe haven of Dubai in the U.S. allied United Arab Emirates. And that just about does it here for today. You've been listening to the reading of the Dubuque Herald on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. And I'm your reader, Peter Welch. Thank you for listening. Have a great day.